In this module, I wish to talk about anxiety disorders as they occur following traumatic brain injury. I'll also briefly mention anxiety disorders that occur prior to the brain injury and the effect that the brain injury may have on the anxiety disorder. As with the previous modules, I will commence by talking about the diagnostic issues related to anxiety disorders and traumatic brain injury, and then focus on a description of the incidence of the conditions, possible etiological mechanisms, and then outline each of the disorders and how they can be managed in a person who has had a traumatic brain injury. Anxiety disorders following traumatic brain injury are in fact an area that there is very little known about. Until the advent of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual and its associated diagnostic interview schedule, there were in fact very few studies that looked at anxiety disorders following traumatic brain injury. There has always been the reporting in the literature of outcome following brain injury, the fact that people will have anxiety symptoms and states of agitation and distress, but very little work has been done to characterise the nature of those anxiety disorders and what implications they have on people who have had a traumatic brain injury. For this talk, I'm going to focus on the diagnostic groupings as they are described in DSM-4. And I recommend that listeners to this presentation have DSM-4 available so that they may understand the different diagnostic groupings that I'm going to describe. And where possible, if there is any deviation from this, I will mention it within the talk itself. In a person who's had a traumatic brain injury who then develops anxiety symptoms, these may reach the severity criteria of an actual disorder. The difference often is the number of symptoms that the person has. And in head injury, often people have a number of subsyndromal anxiety states rather than the full diagnostic condition that we would normally see, which effectively means that they have a number of anxiety symptoms, but they're not going to have enough of the symptoms to be able to meet the criteria required to have the disorder in its own right. When you look at the anxiety symptoms that people can have following a traumatic brain injury, it's effectively all the anxiety symptoms we see in general psychiatry in people who do not have an organic lesion. There are, however, some modifications, and in fact some of the anxiety disorders that occur following brain injury have provided very useful information for our understanding of psychiatric conditions where there is no brain injury. If a person develops an anxiety disorder following a brain injury, the most appropriate diagnosis is that of an anxiety disorder due to a head injury, where we specify the type of anxiety disorder. So, for example, if a person develops an obsessive-compulsive disorder, the diagnosis would be anxiety disorder due to head injury, with the specifier being obsessive-compulsive symptomatology. Some people may prefer to use the diagnosis of pure obsessive compulsive disorder, but I think if we can provide a fairly close time relationship between when the person's had the head injury and the onset of the symptoms, it's important to diagnose it as a psychiatric disorder that's occurring due to a medical condition, because this has very significant implications for that individual and may have further ramifications, for example, with regards to litigation. So it's important to remember the specifier in as far as the diagnosis is concerned. As I mentioned earlier, subsyndromal states are very common in the anxiety disorders following brain injury, and we need to be aware that people may have anxiety symptoms without a full diagnosis. One of the things that's very well known when a person has a brain injury is that the actual brain injury can significantly influence the expression of their anxiety disorder, and possibly more strongly than in some of the other psychiatric conditions. One of the key problems that can occur is that there can be a dissociation for the person between their physical symptoms, anxiety, and the expression of the emotion associated with that. Particularly in people who have damage to the frontal areas of the brain, where they have a loss of an ability to express emotion, or a condition called aprosody, there can be the physical symptoms of anxiety and no emotional association with this. The other situation that can arise is where a person has damage in the brainstem and they develop all the physical symptoms but have no equivalent emotional association. So they might have tachycardia, diarrhea, vomiting, hyperventilation, the physical concomitants of an anxiety state, but they actually don't feel, in an emotional sense, anxious. And this is quite a unique syndrome associated with brainstem lesions that can occur. Of course, it becomes problematic because the diagnosis can be very difficult, because as with all the conditions described under the anxiety disorders, the important component is the association with the feeling state of being anxious. And anxiety can be expressed in a number of ways by people, but often it is a fear, and the fear is thought to be irrational to the situation that provokes the fear. The incidence of anxiety disorders is a situation that we've only recently come to study and to understand. As I mentioned earlier on, the use of the diagnostic interview schedule that goes with the DSM-4 manual has really enlarged our understanding about anxiety disorders following head injury. And a number of key studies have now been conducted using the diagnostic interview, and we found that anxiety disorders in fact occur quite frequently following traumatic brain injury. These studies have only been done in the last 10 years and are readily available in the literature. There are two key studies, one is a community study, which was part of the epidemiological catchment study that was a very large multi-city study in the early 1990s looking at the incidence of psychiatric illness in the community. And there has also been a large study done in traumatic brain injury outpatients. When looking at the incidence of the symptomatology, the studies will suggest that between 11 to 70% of patients with traumatic brain injury may have an anxiety symptom or an anxiety disorder. The anxiety disorders tend to be around the 10% mark, and the anxiety symptoms up to 70% of patients. In the table on the slide, you can see that a number of diagnoses have been assessed in people with traumatic brain injury, and that the occurrence of these conditions is quite high. For example, obsessive compulsive disorder is said to occur in about 6.5% of people who've had a traumatic brain injury. This is quite a significant increased risk compared to that of the general population. Panic disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder also seem to occur quite commonly, but these conditions are also quite prevalent in the community, and so the absolute relative risk or increased risk of getting these conditions after a brain injury is only a little bit higher or mildly higher than one would expect in the general population. We don't really understand why people necessarily get anxiety disorders following a brain injury. It is probably the one area of traumatic brain injury where the interplay between biological factors, social factors and psychological factors really come into play, and this group of diagnoses is probably the best description to fit in that biopsychosocial model that we're all taught about when we undergo our training. What we do know is that the right hemisphere is particularly important for the regulation of emotional states, and that if you get damage in the right hemisphere, that you are likely to have a condition that is associated with anxiety. Now, you might remember earlier on that I spoke about people with damage in the frontal area, the right frontal area, having problems with the expression of emotion. And this is a very isolated area in the right frontal area where people have reduced awareness. But more generally, damage in the right hemisphere and in the limbic system within the right hemisphere has an increased association with anxiety symptoms. In fact, in the mood disorders, if a person has not only left hemisphere lesions in the left frontal area, but also right hemisphere lesions, their depressive disorder is actually associated with a significant amount of anxiety. We can say quite unequivocally that family history, litigation, and the severity of injury do not play a role in the onset of the anxiety disorders. So there is no association of increased family history. People who are in litigation do not have more anxiety symptoms than those that are not, and that anxiety conditions can occur regardless of the severity of the brain injury. So people with mild traumatic brain injury have significant anxiety symptoms or disorders, as well as those with severe. This will become quite important when we look at the post-traumatic stress disorders. If people are injured at a young age, and if they have a pre-injury history of alcohol use, these do appear to be risk factors for the development of anxiety, and if they have less formal education. Now, there may be an association with education and the psychological mindedness of the person, and this might explain why less formal education is a risk factor, but it is one of the risk factors that have emerged. One of the most clear indicators, however, of the emergence of anxiety states after brain injury has to do with what a person's coping style is like. You may be aware that psychiatrists and psychologists will make assessments of people with regards to their coping style, and this is a general term to describe how a person might deal with a particular situation, stress, or traumatic event in their life. And there have been some very good studies to show that patients who have an avoidant coping style, so they try and avoid any kind of trigger or stimulus or not deal with the issues, are actually much more vulnerable for developing anxiety disorders following traumatic brain injury and for the maintenance of those conditions. I'm now going to go on and talk about the individual disorders and conditions and try and emphasise some of the important characteristics that we know to exist in this area. As I mentioned in the very early stages, there isn't a great deal published about anxiety disorders following brain injury. The one area where there has been more work done is that in the area of post-traumatic stress disorder. As you're probably aware, post-traumatic stress disorder became a formal diagnosis with specific criteria in DSM-3. In the old days, it was considered accident neurosis or war neurosis would be a descriptor for this condition. With DSM-3, there came about very specific criteria for what constituted a post-traumatic stress disorder. There have been modifications to this diagnosis with the revisions of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. And one of the very important revisions has to do with the severity specifier of to what event actually can lead to a post-traumatic stress disorder. The severity specifier is actually extremely important in the area of traumatic brain injury. The reality is, for a person to be allowed to have a post-traumatic stress disorder after being involved in a brain injury, the event that caused the brain injury has to be one where the person felt that their life was at risk or at threat or a serious injury. Since most of our traumatic brain injuries are from motor vehicle accidents, it really means that it has to be a motor vehicle accident where there was significant injury, for example, entrapment, or other parties significantly injured. The minor bump rear end kind of accident really doesn't reach the severity criteria to allow a person to make a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. So the diagnostic criteria are actually quite important in terms of when you make a diagnosis of a post-traumatic stress disorder. If a person hasn't met the severity criteria, then we usually would make the diagnosis of an adjustment disorder with anxious and depressed mood. What we can say quite clearly is that the severity of the brain injury does not influence whether or not a person gets a post-traumatic stress disorder. There's always been the thought that if a person has a head injury that results in unconsciousness, that this should exclude the person getting a post-traumatic stress disorder. Because after the severity criteria, the next most important criteria has to do with re-experiencing of the event, either via dreams or traumatic recollections, flashbacks. People who are rendered unconscious by the head injury often don't remember the event, and it was therefore thought that if they were truly rendered unconscious, they wouldn't be able to develop a post-traumatic stress disorder. Well, we in fact know that this is a fallacy and that being rendered unconscious does not protect you from having a post-traumatic stress disorder. The incidence of post-traumatic stress, regardless of the severity of brain injury, is between 17 to 21.7% of people with a head injury. That statistic of 27.1% in fact derives from a paper that was published in Brain Injury from research that was conducted in New South Wales from people with severe closed head injury. What the study did find is that in patients who were more severely injured, that they were more likely to have pseudo-memories of the traumatic event than true memories of the traumatic event, and that they had less experience of the traumatic recollections than a group that weren't rendered unconscious, but yet they still had all the symptom criteria associated with post-traumatic stress disorder. The reference for this paper will be included at the end of the presentation, and I really recommend that you actually read this paper because it's quite interesting and illuminating with regards to post-traumatic stress and severe head injury. What the study also found was that if people had an avoidant coping style, they were more likely to get a post-traumatic stress disorder. Other risk factors for the development of post-traumatic stress include a past history of psychiatric illness, and if the person has been involved in some form of civilian trauma, for example, assault. Natural disasters do not seem to have a significant impact with regards to the onset of post-traumatic stress unless there are a number of other vulnerability factors that were evident. What you can see with people who've had a traumatic brain injury is that while they may not remember the specific event, sometimes they can remember things that occurred up to the point of time that they lost consciousness. They may have islands of memory, immediately following the head injury, and they become incorporated in their traumatic events. And finally, they may in fact generate what we call pseudo-memories of the traumatic event. And these pseudo-memories can be generated by family members talking to them about it. It might be by seeing photos or footage of the scene of the accident, reading articles about it. All this information can be incorporated into their memories and lead to them having a pseudo-memory about their own incident and subsequently having all the other symptoms of a post-traumatic stress disorder. The presence of pseudo-memories, particularly in the severely head-injured, should not be an indicator that the person does not have a genuine post-traumatic stress disorder, but rather we need to understand how these pseudo-memories might occur in a person who has been significantly traumatised. One of the issues that emerged when reviewing the literature about post-traumatic stress disorder was how we make a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder in people who are head-injured. Some of the studies that you might read in the literature use either the impact of life events scale or the impact events scale or a post-traumatic stress disorder scale to make the diagnosis of a post-traumatic stress disorder. In the case of the person who is severely brain injured, one needs to be cautious about using a rating scale to make the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress. What we need to do is by all means use the rating scales as a screening tool, but we then need to follow it up with a clinical interview. And the reason that I say this is that a number of symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder in fact overlap with a traumatic brain injury, and that the frontal impairments that a person with a traumatic brain injury, those impairments that they have, actually influence how they answer the questionnaire. And so they can in fact respond to a lot of the questions in the questionnaires in a positive way, but yet not actually truly experience a post-traumatic stress disorder. Being aware that there is this problem with false positives is very important, because often the patients, in fact, can become quite resentful that someone has told them they've got a post-traumatic stress disorder when they, in fact, don't have it. And also, it can be the material can be sometimes used inappropriately in treating settings where it really isn't necessary. So always remember that while the rating scales can be good to do a screening of people, it's very important that we follow it up with a clinical interview, particularly in the case of people with significant traumatic brain injury. The other important factor to bear in mind with post-traumatic stress disorder is that people who have had a severe head injury, that their frontal lobe impairments will impact not only on the expression of the post-traumatic stress disorder, but also on how the condition is managed. We are unable to identify any specific lesion that causes post-traumatic stress disorder. We do know in people who have post-traumatic stress disorder and do not have a brain injury that there are functional abnormalities in their temporal areas and in the limbic region, but there's been no specific area of the brain identified as being implicated in post-traumatic stress. And when you consider how complex a diagnosis is, this probably is quite obvious to you. What has been shown, however, is that occasionally having a brain injury can in fact cure, in inverted commas, a person's post-traumatic stress disorder. There have been a number of case reports of people who had post-traumatic stress disorders and then subsequently went on to have significant brain injuries. And what they've found is that the person's anxiety symptoms and hyperarousal symptoms from their post-traumatic stress disorder are reduced after the brain injury. And this often involves damage to the frontal circuits, and we also know by people who have had psychosurgery for various psychiatric conditions that if you lesion particularly areas of the cingulate gyrus in the brain, that is, cut that area or damage it, that you can reduce the experience of anxiety. So sometimes, in fact, people's post-traumatic stress condition, if it's predating the head injury, can in fact be improved by having a head injury, but that there's no specific lesion that's going to cause a post-traumatic stress disorder. People who've had mild brain injuries tend to have a higher rate of post-traumatic stress disorders than people who have had severe brain injuries, but the incidence is still quite high. The next commonest anxiety condition that you can see following a traumatic brain injury is that of a panic disorder. As you'll all know, a panic disorder is where people have very discrete episodes of severe anxiety, where they fear that something is going to go wrong or they may die, associated with a number of physical symptoms. However, we don't really have a good description of what a panic attack is in a person who's had a brain injury. And over many years of clinical experience of treating patients with brain injury, the number of patients that I've had that have reported panic attacks is in fact quite low. There are probably a variety of reasons for this, often I think embarrassment, but also that the person isn't able to say what situation triggers their panic attacks, and so they feel reluctant to discuss it or disclose it. The other factor is that they may not actually recognise that they're having a panic attack because they've got a general increased amount of anxiety associated with all the cognitive problems they have from a head injury. It's likely that panic attacks don't occur all that much more frequently in head injured patients because the incidence of panic attacks, in fact, is quite high in our community generally. But what you will see is a person who's not previously had panic attacks developing panic attacks post head injury. The criteria in terms of why people get panic attacks has also not been well understood. We know that people can have their first panic attack when they're faced with a task that is too cognitively challenging for them, or for patients who have overlearned a task and then when they go to practice that task in the real world, find that something else has happened, something unpredictable, and if they have a somewhat anxious nature, that this can precipitate them having a panic attack. The patients that I have treated over the years who have presented with panic disorders or significant anxiety symptoms like a panic disorder are often patients whose diagnosis of traumatic brain injury was missed in the early stages. And these are patients who had significant orthopaedic injury as well as head injury. They were managed in orthopaedic wards and actually fell through the system as far as the diagnosis of their head injury was concerned. They then spend some time off work because of their orthopaedic injuries. And it's when they go back to work and they start doing things that are cognitively challenging that they find they can't cope with that situation because they don't know what's going on. And if they're fairly high-stressed individuals, they can experience their first panic attack. Unfortunately, by the time they often present for treatment, the panic symptoms are really quite well entrenched and reinforced, and also the person finds it very difficult to accept and understand that they've had a brain injury. And as we all know, it can be very difficult to convince a person that their impairments are related to a brain injury, particularly when it hasn't been diagnosed in the first instance. Overall, we don't have a lot of information about panic attacks, and this might be surprising considering it can happen in up to 9.2% of head injured patients, but it's likely that it's very similar to that we see in non-head injured people, but that often the patients are not going to be able to tell us what the precipitant is for their head injury. Obsessive compulsive disorder is another anxiety disorder that can occur following head injury. It's actually been the study of people with obsessive compulsive disorder that have arisen due to organic brain lesions that has helped us understand obsessive compulsive disorder in the general population. People who have obsessive compulsive disorder and who haven't had a brain injury have abnormalities of neuropsychometric assessment and have also been shown to have abnormalities on functional and static MRI. So we think that obsessive compulsive disorder is one of these model diseases that has a biological basis, and obviously looking at people who've had head injuries and then develop obsessive compulsive disorder is going to increase our understanding about obsessive compulsive disorder in general, but also to increase our understanding about the function of the brain. The incidence of obsessive compulsive disorder is actually quite high in brain injured patients when you compare it with the general population. The other thing I need to point out is that while people can have a obsessive compulsive disorder with the obsessions, which are the recurrent ruminative thoughts, they're often a thought about something going wrong or bad or devastating happening, with the accompanying compulsions, which are the repetitive stereotypic behaviours that in many ways are like a perseveration of a motor activity, that the obsessive compulsive symptoms can also be a subsyndromal presentation where people have a situation of what I call organic obsessiveness, where they're particularly focused on things being ordered and in a certain way, and that this organic obsessiveness often arises in people who had obsessional traits prior to the injury. They like things to be in a specific way. And then after their brain injury, they develop the habit of having things exactly in a certain way to try and compensate for their impairment. The distinguishing between organic obsessiveness and an obsessive compulsive disorder following a head injury can in fact be quite difficult, and the treatment effectively should be the same, and I'll talk about that more later on. We know that if you structurally damage the circuit that involves the frontal areas, the basal ganglia, the thalamic and cortical circuits, and there's a very neat neuronal circuitry that exists there, the damage in this area is going to produce obsessive compulsive disorder. In some areas, if the damage occurs, it seems to be that the person cannot filter out normal thoughts. They're experienced more intensely, and those thoughts are associated with significant anxiety. In other situations, the person develops a behaviour and they can't circumvent or stop the behaviour. Right hemisphere injuries seem to be particularly important for the development of obsessive compulsive disorder, although some studies have suggested that people need to have bilateral, that is, damage to both hemispheres, to develop an obsessive compulsive disorder. When comparing people with an organic obsessive compulsive disorder with that of a non-organic or idiopathic condition, we do know that those people who develop an organic obsessive compulsive disorder, that they don't have a greater incidence of family history. So family history doesn't contribute to the onset, and they tend to have less obsessional ideas. Now, one of the things we do know with people with obsessive compulsive disorder is that they frequently don't come to diagnosis. It's only the very severe obsessives that present for treatment. So people can be symptomatic for many years, and when they have been symptomatic for many years, the anxiety and the obsessions that influence their compulsive behaviour has in fact become forgotten or is less significant in the presentation. In patients with an organic obsessive compulsive disorder, often the obsessions are not particularly obvious to the person, have been forgotten or are no longer that significant, and the person is often doesn't report being necessarily anxious, particularly because they've never actually thought to stop the obsessive behaviour. Because patients with obsessive compulsive disorder often experience anxiety when you stop them doing the ritual, and for many obsessive compulsive following head injury, no one actually thinks to try and stop or impede the behaviour, so they may not report anxiety symptoms. But a very important distinguishing feature seems to be the relatively insignificant part about the obsessions. Of course, the compulsive behaviours can be not only a motor behaviour, but also a cognitive behaviour, so they can have cognitive rituals. These can be quite hard to detect on occasions, but if you have someone who seems to focus on a particular thought all the time, this may in fact be a cognitive ritual that is a component of an obsessive compulsive disorder. In the diagnostic and statistical manual interview schedule that's often used to make us epidemiological studies, there is this diagnostic grouping called phobic disorders or anxiety disorders. It's a kind of everything else that people can be anxious with diagnosis put together. But it includes mainly social phobia and specific phobias. And the phobic disorders are also quite common following a traumatic brain injury. And what you need to know is that comorbid situations are quite common. So people, for example, may have panic disorder and major depression. They might have panic disorder and a specific phobia and a major depression. They could have, for example, post-traumatic stress disorder and major depression. So there's a lot of comorbidity that occurs. And almost certainly the phobic disorders are actually quite common, about 11.2%, which is quite a significant increased risk. In fact, quite common often because the diagnostic criteria can be fairly specific, or particularly in the case of people who've had severe head injuries, they'll often have a car phobia rather than a full-blown post-traumatic stress disorder. And the reason that they get this diagnosis is that they don't have a lot of the traumatic recollections, and they may not have a lot of the hyperarousal symptoms. They simply have the phobic avoidance symptoms, and what they avoid is being in motor vehicles. It's very important, particularly for rehab teams, to be aware of the fact that people can have a specific phobia to a car, because some of the strategies and therapies that they might want to plan involve being transported in a vehicle, and the patients don't have the techniques or the knowledge to cope with the anxiety symptoms that may be accompanied with this. And sometimes failure to progress in rehab can be due to a specific phobia regarding vehicles. And it's a question that rehab specialists and health professionals really need to be asking all their patients about how they feel when they go in a car. Because the fact that they've had a severe brain injury and don't remember being in the car doesn't prevent them from developing a specific phobia about being in a car. And this can have quite a significant effect in terms of their functioning and outcome. For the people who develop a social phobia, we know that they have an increased incidence of problems with regards to their social skills. They often also have problems with regards to noise sensitivity. People in the area of brain injury will be familiar with the fact that someone who has a traumatic brain injury often has difficulties with a lot of conflicting stimuli and places that are very noisy. What they find is that they can't concentrate in these environments, they might get very agitated, or it precipitates headaches. And people who have a noise intolerance will often become quite socially phobic because they don't want to be exposed in environments where there is a lot of noise, and they will actively avoid those situations. And they're often fearful of scrutiny of people in public because they're fearful of how they might respond. This is also for patients who have a significant awareness of their impairments. And the phobic disorders is often a situation where impaired awareness is not a problem. In fact, they often have hyperacute awareness. They're, you know, ultimately very aware of their problems with regards to, example, language, or their problems with memory and concentration. And this acute awareness causes them to avoid situations where they feel they might be ridiculed or embarrassed in public. And again, we need to be aware of the presence of the social phobia so that we can develop specific treatment strategies for those people so that they don't fail in other areas of their rehabilitation. The diagnosis of anxiety disorders can be very difficult in someone who's had a traumatic brain injury. I mentioned earlier on that there can be this dissociation between physical symptomatology and the experience of emotion, but also because often the patient feels quite embarrassed about the nature of their symptomatology. For example, you can imagine that someone might be very embarrassed to admit that they get fearful about being in a car because, you know, motor vehicle transportation is so common in our community. And that people may not be acutely aware that they're embarrassed about their performance in social situations. So the diagnosis can be difficult. This is also, I think, one of these diagnostic areas where it's very important to get a clear association with the onset of the symptomatology and what was going on and what the person's premorbid personality was like. Because premorbid personality is probably very important in the emergence of anxiety states. People with avoidant coping styles or people with high expectations of themselves pre-injury may be much more vulnerable to the development of anxiety disorders. And so getting a very clear pre-injury personality history and getting a good understanding of the chronology of the emergence of the anxiety symptoms can be extremely important. As with all the other conditions that I've talked about, the exclusion of other psychiatric disorders is extremely important. I mentioned earlier that you can have a number of comorbid states with anxiety disorders, for example, depressive disorders, but you can also have anxiety symptoms in, for example, schizophrenia, in people with dementia or amnestic disorders. They can also be quite anxious and have a sort of a catastrophic reaction when confronted with a situation where they don't know a response or answer. But there are a number of physical organic states that can also mimic an anxiety disorder. Cardiac conditions can be one, but also thyroid abnormalities are also important. And finally, as in all the other diagnoses, the issue of drug use. For example, the use of amphetamines and stimulant medications can produce significant anxiety symptoms. And also if a person has been abusing benzodiazepines or alcohol, they can also develop quite significant anxiety symptomatology. And one of the situations where this particularly can become a problem is a person who's still in the rehabilitation setting and going home on weekend leave, consuming large quantities of substances, and then becomes quite anxious when they're back in the rehabilitation setting. So we need to screen for the drug and alcohol problems in anxiety disorders, as with the other conditions. The other important thing to bear in mind is that people with anxiety disorders will try to symptomatically treat their condition, and they will do so using, for example, benzodiazepines and alcohol, and particularly alcohol because it's so readily available. And men with anxiety disorders often have a higher association with substance abuse disorders. The management of the anxiety disorders in people who have had brain injuries is effectively that of some general principles that I'd like to outline, and then there are some very specific comments about the various conditions and disorders. Professor Bryant has done a great deal of work on looking at post-traumatic stress disorders and people with traumatic brain injury. In a number of his papers, he's outlined in quite specific detail some of the therapeutic modifications that need to be made when treating people with anxiety disorders and brain injury. And I refer you to Professor Bryant's papers to get a deeper understanding of this area. But if I can summarise the important changes that have to occur, in the management of anxiety disorders, the cognitive behaviour therapies are probably more important than the use of pharmacological agents. But as with all psychiatric conditions, we really need to have a multimodal approach to treatment. And as with the other psychiatric disorders, the involvement in the family in management is important, and maybe more important in this area than in some of the other areas as far as management's concerned. When trying to devise a behavioural program or a cognitive program for a person with an anxiety disorder after a brain injury, we need to utilise diaries, notes, and to structure the program in a very discrete and specific manner. Obviously, the more severely head injured the person, the more important it is to rely on the issues of structure, note-taking, and to break down the information in small chunks of information, bearing in mind, for example, the attention or concentration problems that the person might have. As we all know, someone who's had a brain injury will often have problems sustaining attention. They might not be able to deal with complex information and complex instructions. Being aware of their neuropsychometric problems will enable the psychologist or other treating specialist to devise an appropriate behavioural program that takes into account these cognitive problems. Any form of cognitive behaviour therapy in someone who is head injured must rely on note taking and giving the person notes to take home with them to remind them of what has been said in the sessions. Typically, when you're managing these conditions in someone who's head injured, you need to teach the person some very basic strategies and principles first before targeting specific aspects of their therapy. So, for example, you need to know that they can relax themselves properly and manage their anxiety symptom before you get to expose them to the environment, to the situation which causes the anxiety. And often this means that you have to make sure the person has overlearned the procedure so that they will be able to draw on it in the situation where they are stressed, that is, a situation where the anxiety is provoked. In the behaviour therapies, it's extremely important to utilise an assistant so that they can follow through with the behaviour therapy. And this is particularly important in the area of exposure. People who are head injured are often quite impulsive and they won't sustain an act. So if you're, for example, trying to get them to expose themselves to an anxiety-provoking situation, what's likely to happen is that they're likely to withdraw from that situation quite quickly, and so they're not able to habituate to the stimulus that causes them to be anxious. In the utilisation of an assistant, you get them to actually follow through. We also know in people who have brain injured that it's important that they learn strategies in an errorless environment so that they actually follow through the strategy correctly. Now, this is in all areas of their rehabilitation, but it's also important in their cognitive behaviour therapy. You want the assistant to make sure that they're learning the strategies appropriately without any errors so that they can lay down a memory trace that is going to assist them in the future rather than having some problems in it. One of the most important general principles, however, that we need to remember is to recognise when the behaviour or the anxiety state has really developed to provide the person a way of surviving in their environment. And the cognitive behaviour therapist needs to be aware that some of these symptoms are in fact the patient's way of dealing with their head injured symptoms so that they can function better in their environment, and that we shouldn't be interpreting that as resistance to change or resistance to get better, but understanding that the resistance in fact is a way of allowing that person to continue to function without abnormal anxiety. And we have to be somewhat creative of how we're going to get around those problems. With the cognitive therapy, we have to be very aware of what kind of limitations the person's cognitive impairment will have. Obviously, in patients who have a mild traumatic brain injury, they may not have as severe cognitive impairments, but these are still going to impact on the person's presentation. You need to make sure the tasks fit within the person's concentration span, that the instructions are quite simple, remembering that a lot of patients can't follow more than one or two step commands, and that we need to make sure that they've rehearsed the strategy very effectively before we ask them to complete the strategy. And finally, we often need to have more contact with a person who's had a head injury and needs behaviour therapy than you may normally plan in terms of the management of any other anxiety disorder. And the role of overlearning the skills cannot be reinforced more often. It's extremely important that the patients overlearn their skills. And the area of post-traumatic stress disorder is one where this becomes extremely important. With post-traumatic stress disorder, you need to make the general modifications. You need to make sure that the person has learnt the strategies well, that they are able to utilise those strategies in situations before you get them to be exposed to that situation. In people with severe brain injury, particularly if they have a tendency to perseverate, if you get them to expose themselves to the traumatic event before they've learnt to manage the feeling states that go with that, you can end up in a situation where, in fact, the patient is being traumatised further and increase their anxiety symptoms. So you want to make sure that the person with a post-traumatic stress disorder and a significant head injury has really got the right environment to expose themselves, you know, utilising an assistant. There are no controlled trials of treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder in people who have had head injury. We know that cognitive behaviour therapy is the standard treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. You're also probably aware of a therapy called eye movement desensitisation reprocessing. While there have been no published case studies about the utilisation of this therapy, almost certainly I can say that I've had a number of head injured patients who have found that eye movement desensitisation, and these are patients with severe traumatic brain injuries, that they have in fact found the therapy to be effective. So that this is possibly an alternative therapy for someone, particularly with a more treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder, that we should consider it. Again, there are no studies looking at the use of medication in post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. There have been a number of published studies demonstrating that various agents, particularly the antidepressants, can be effective in reducing the hyperarousal that we see in post-traumatic stress disorder and enabling patients to complete their therapy. We also know that post-traumatic stress disorder has a high association with the mood disorders, particularly depressive disorders, and clearly treating that depressive disorder with antidepressants will assist in enabling the person to complete their cognitive behaviour therapy of their post-traumatic stress disorder. In terms of the medication choices, I'd refer you back particularly to the tutorial on mood disorders where I discuss the antidepressants in greater detail, because the principles that apply to using antidepressants in mood disorders following brain injury also apply to using them in this diagnostic group. Panic disorder, as I said before, is really a situation that we don't know a great deal about. One of the things that's quite interesting is that, you know, because we don't have a lot of literature about it, there really are no guidelines as far as how it should be managed or treated. In clinical practice, I think a combined approach is usually the best type of strategy. And you've got to make an assessment of how severely anxious the person is as to terms of what treatment you're going to give them first. We know that you can induce a panic disorder in people by depleting their serotonin, and so serotonin depletion is implicated somewhere in the etiology of panic disorder. Therefore, using drugs that increase the amount of serotonin, that is the SSRIs, is probably quite an appropriate and effective strategy in the management of panic disorder in traumatically brain injured patients. The important thing to remember is that benzodiazepine should probably be avoided in this patient group. Apart from the fact that benzodiazepines can cause a paradoxical reaction, that is, a person can become more aggressive and irritated, the other thing we know is that benzodiazepines affect new learning. So if you've got someone who's got compromised learning due to their brain injury, and you then add a benzodiazepine to their therapy program, you might find that any kind of behaviour therapy that you're trying to utilise or cognitive therapy is ineffective because the person's new learning has been further adversely affected by the pharmacological therapy. That also goes with tricyclic antidepressants. They will also have an impact on memory. The serotonergic selective reuptake inhibitors don't have an effect on learning and memory, and so obviously can be quite safely used in this patient population. As with the other anxiety disorders, but particularly with panic disorder, getting an assistant to help them to practice their exposure is extremely important. And the one thing we need to be very careful about is not inadvertently traumatising our patients to developing panic disorders. It's important to check what the emotional response of the patient was to, for example, a rehabilitation task. If you find that the person got very anxious in the rehabilitation task, the next step is to ask whether they had a panic attack or something that was very similar to a panic attack by describing discreetly the symptoms of the same. Because I've seen a number of situations where patients have inadvertently been asked to carry out tasks, particularly in the community, where they've had repeated panic attacks and they seem to fail their rehabilitation, and it's really because of their anxiety state. If we then manage their anxiety disorder, they can obviously complete their rehabilitation. Now, with obsessive compulsive disorder, the management of obsessive compulsive disorder is slightly different in when a person's had a brain injury. And the reason I say this is that often it's suggested that people with obsessive compulsive disorder should have cognitive behaviour therapy first, and only when they fail that should they go on to medication. For some of our patients who are significantly head injured, they can't benefit from the cognitive behaviour therapy in the early stages because the OCD causes so much anxiety that their new learning and cognitive skills are further adversely affected. And that's something I've not emphasised so far in my discussion. But particularly with the anxiety disorders, if a person has a significant anxiety disorder, it can actually make their underlying cognitive problems from the head injury significantly worse. Because if you're stressed and anxious, your concentration, attention, and therefore your memory is adversely affected. And that increased arousal really impacts on their ability to utilise what skills they still have. So in obsessive compulsive disorder following a head injury, because they're often not necessarily anxious and the behaviour is so well learnt, it can be very difficult to get them to utilise CBT. And so in this case, using medication is often the first line of therapy, and then you introduce the cognitive behaviour therapy subsequently. In the non-acquired obsessive compulsive disorder, clomipramine has always been a mainstay of therapy. It's been found to be very effective in obsessive compulsive disorder. But interestingly enough, case studies using clomipramine in head injured patients have suggested it's not effective. And the reason it's probably not effective has to do with the cognitive effects of clomipramine on someone who's had a traumatic brain injury. So the SSRI drugs are the treatment of choice. They've been shown to be effective in the non-organic OCD, and they are equally effective in the organic cases of OCD. The utilisation of behaviour therapy often comes after the person has had a reduction in the level of their behaviours, and you can actually appeal to their awareness and insight to get them to reduce the behaviours. Obviously, having an assistant available for the exposure component of the treatment is very important. One word of caution, though, is that people with obsessive compulsive disorders may have developed rituals to deal with an impairment they've got from the brain injury. And the classic example is a person who compulsively checks. People who've had brain injuries often are very acutely aware of their forgetfulness, and they will develop strategies to try and overcome that. Where it becomes a disorder is where the amount of checking stops them from doing their normal thing. And I can remember many years ago a lady who was referred to me who tended to check to make sure she didn't leave the iron on or the stove on and that she'd locked the door. But it took her so long to actually get out of the house that she was always late for appointments because she was checking. In these patients, the checking in fact has a positive value in that it prevents them from being exposed to a situation where they could come to harm, for example, leaving a stove on and the house being burnt down. So in this situation, the behaviour therapy often has to involve normalising part of their checking and stopping the excessive component, and that can involve getting them to use checklists before they leave the house. So almost concretising their checking, but getting them to have a reminder that they've done the right checking and then preventing them going back to check yet again. So you have to have a really good understanding of what the obsessive symptoms are about and their compulsive behaviours, because in many cases they will be in fact to try and prevent something going wrong, and these patients are often very fearful of that because to them having had their brain injury is probably the worst thing that could have happened to them, and they don't want something like that to happen again. With the phobic disorders, there are no published studies as far as treatment methods are concerned. I think it's important that we target the key symptoms. So if a person has a car phobia, that is dealt with. The imaginal exposure to these triggers is not a very effective strategy for people who are brain injured, and often what needs to happen is that they actually need to be exposed to the environmental trigger. They're not as good at using imaginal processes, so you have to take them out to the real world and actually deal with their anxiety with them physically in the environment that causes the anxiety. Using group therapy is one strategy that we can use for the social phobia, and teaching them techniques and strategies to cope with some of the things that precipitate their social phobia. It can be quite difficult for patients with very acute awareness to overcome the social phobia, and obviously work in terms of group and socialisation and communication skills become very important. The other type of therapy that's very important for people who are socially phobic is to teach them assertiveness, and in fact to teach them skills to allow them to be able to get out of environments they find stressful without causing themselves to be embarrassed or ashamed. The response that people have to treatment with the anxiety disorders has not been documented. From a clinical perspective, I can say that the patients often do fairly well for certain disorders with treatment. For example, the obsessive compulsive disorders are actually quite easy to manage. But some disorders do less well, particularly the car phobia is often a anxiety disorder that can be quite hard to manage and to eradicate. And also the post-traumatic stress disorders can tend to be quite chronic conditions, and particularly in patients who have the avoidant coping style, this almost reinforces the disorder and makes it so much more difficult to deal with. The response that patients have is usually fairly good to the symptoms, but again they tend to have a situation of chronicity. And if you look at the general outcome studies, we know that patients will complain of anxiety and emotional symptoms many years following their head injury, so that the symptoms do appear to be quite refractory to change, and occasionally they can in fact become worse as time progresses, as the person learns more and more situations that provoke their anxiety disorder. In summary then, we know that the anxiety disorders do occur following brain injury, and probably at a higher incidence than most people expect. We do have to remember that anxiety disorders are quite common in the community. In particular, however, post-traumatic stress disorder and obsessive-compulsive disorders occur more commonly in patients who are head injured than we would expect in the general community. The presence of loss of consciousness is not a determinant of whether or not a person will get an anxiety disorder, particularly a post-traumatic stress disorder. What we can generally say is that patients with right hemisphere lesions are more prone to the development of anxiety disorders as a group in general, but factors such as family history are not considered as important. As far as the anxiety disorders are concerned, it's always important to remember this is the one grouping where the biological factors probably interplay with the social and psychological factors more so than in some of the other disorders. In patients who develop anxiety disorders or symptoms following traumatic brain injury, we need to be assertive with regards to the treatment, be aware that some of our rehabilitation strategies may in fact provoke the conditions and develop strategies to deal with this, and that our patients are likely to have a chronic and ongoing course.